If you need to follow a specific eating plan because of health concerns, you know it can take time to do that. It can take some energy, certainly, and cost some money. So having advice for shortcuts and quick and easy recipes, I think, is pretty important. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and really pleased to welcome Carol Fenster to the program. Carol is the author of a dozen gluten-free cookbooks, including her most recent, the one we're going to be talking about the most today. It's called 100 Best Quick Gluten-Free Recipes. She's the former associate editor of Living Without magazine, and her work has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Gluten-Free Living, and elsewhere. And Carol Fenster, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry. Happy to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you along. How did you get started on gluten-free cooking?
It happened a long time ago. Back in 1988, I was diagnosed with, at that time, we simply said, don't eat wheat. We didn't even use the word gluten, but I'd had a lifetime of sinus problems, and it just kept getting worse and worse to the point that I sought medical help, and fortunately, some wise doctor figured out that it was wheat that was causing my problem, and so I went home and tried to find something to eat and quickly realized that it wasn't going to be quite as easy as I thought. And that began my quest for revamping all of my own recipes so I could eat. And one recipe led to another. And then I learned eventually that other people were having similar problems. Although back then in 1988, there weren't that many of us, and we didn't have the internet, so we couldn't find each other. So it was more a matter of finding someone by chance. And one book led to another, and here we are, number 12.
Yeah, that's absolutely wonderful. And your 1,000 Gluten-Free Recipes book, that won some awards. That is sort of the tome, isn't it, of gluten?
It is the tome. It took me 3 years to write it, and it's virtually, at the time, it came out in 2008. At that time, it was everything I knew about cooking. We really didn't do anything in those recipes to shorten the time that we spent on preparing food. And of course, that's what led to this latest book of more quick recipes. But yeah, it took me 3 years to do it. It was quite an undertaking. And
yes.
But I'm really glad I did it. And I refer to it often myself.
You know, I was, as you were talking about your own situation, I was thinking back to friends who probably 20 years ago now, we're just could not figure out what was wrong with one son who just had so much trouble with eating. It took a while to, for the doctor, one doctor finally to say, well, you know what, there's some intolerance going. This guy needs a gluten-free diet. And as you say, there were that's probably, I think it's easier to diagnose these days, but 20 years ago it was. It took a little bit of looking around to find the right diagnosis.
Exactly. And people were not trained, doctors were not trained to look for it. Medical doctors really didn't have much training, and the testing wasn't as sophisticated as it is today. And there was also a different mindset. I remember when I was told not to eat wheat, and I didn't even tell anybody for about 5 years because nobody would believe me. And I was accused of trying to gain attention for myself and faking it, and it was all in my head. And so I just didn't talk about it. But now doctors are more aware. They are more able to investigate with the proper test and reach a correct diagnosis. So we've come a long, long way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, somebody asked me the other day, what is gluten exactly? And I said, listen to my show, because Carol Fenster is going to tell us exactly what it is.
Well, back when I was diagnosed, I didn't know that it could be a problem. But what it is it's a protein in wheat and other grains like rye and barley and spelt, but primarily in wheat, since we are such a wheat-eating society, that's where our focus tends to be. And it's that property, that protein, the property is that when you ever bake bread, if you've ever done that and you've kneaded the dough and you've pulled it apart and it kind of stretches in these long ribbons as you're moving it around the counter and all that flour, that stretchiness is caused by gluten. And that's, I think, one reason why our society as a whole has really adopted wheat over all these centuries as our main component of baked goods is because it has those wonderful properties for baking. As it turns out, that very property, that gluten, is probably not something that we're all digesting as properly as we should, and maybe we weren't designed to actually eat gluten. That's another argument.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, some of us just don't tolerate it very well, and that leads some of us to either celiac disease or, in my case, I don't have celiac disease. I still get sick, and I guess what I have is something that's been labeled non-celiac gluten sensitivity. But regardless of why you don't eat it, if it makes you sick, you can't have it. And so you have to learn ways of cooking without it.
Talking today with Carol Fenster, author of a dozen books, including the one we're talking about today, 100 Best Quick Gluten-Free Recipes. And join in. Are you an old hand at gluten-free cooking? We'd love to hear your tricks and tips. Maybe you're new to the gluten-free life, whether you yourself or a loved one has an issue. Carol is happy to help out. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show, so you can go there and post a question, or maybe you've got a nice-looking photo of something that you prepared gluten-free. You post that photo as well. Alex in Superior emails to ask if people who don't need to eat gluten-free can benefit from a gluten-free diet. And what do you say to that, Carol?
Well, that is an excellent question, especially right now when we're having a lot of people question whether a gluten-free diet is something that we all need to do or not. My view is that unless you have a medical diagnosis by a physician that says, yes, gluten is a problem for you, regardless of the reason, maybe you're allergic to it, maybe you're intolerant, maybe you have celiac disease, only then should you really adopt a gluten-free diet, because when you adopt a gluten-free diet, you automatically give up a lot of foods that our particular American diet depends on for various nutrients. For example, we fortify bread and pasta and cereals to make sure that they have all the proper nutrients, because we've processed them so far that many of those very important nutrients are taken out, and so we refortify them to bring them back up to speed. When you take those foods out of your diet, which you must do if you are on a gluten-free diet because they change wheat and wheat contains gluten, then you're possibly missing out on those nutrients, and you would then want to seek the advice of a dietitian or nutritionist to make sure that you're replacing those foods with the right gluten-free versions to make sure your diet is healthy. So to answer your listener, no, I don't think anyone should adopt a gluten-free diet unless there's really a good medically sound reason to do so.
Nick in Milwaukee emailed in and wonders what's the best way to make a thick, chewy, gluten-free pizza crust.
Oh, well, I would try my pizza recipe, which is in all of my books.
Yes.
You know, that's really a really good question, and I believe that a lot of the pizza crust that we buy, either in the store now, the gluten-free versions, and the ones we get in restaurants, are these thin, crispy ones that are more like a cracker. And like your listener, that's not the kind I like. I'd like them a little thicker and more like a bread kind of pizza. So one idea is to make the crust thicker, okay, whatever receptacle you use to make your pizza in, whether it's a pizza pan, a flat one, you know, the round kind, or more of a pizza dish that's got sides on it. I simply make the dough thicker as I pat it in or roll it in, whatever you do. And then if you want it to be thicker and chewier, let it rise a little bit before you bake it. Those are the two best ways to do it, not knowing particularly what recipe your listener is using.
Mm. And you should, and you know, before we go any further and before we take phone calls, talk a little bit more about your book. You've got it organized. I love the organization. I also love all the photos.
Aren't those just make you want to lick the page, don't they?
Yes, that's for sure. So, but go ahead and tell us about the book.
Well, it's got 100 recipes and divided among a lot of main dishes, because I think when people think of quick fixing foods quickly, you mainly think of dinner. You know, we all dread that 4 or 5 o'clock refrigerator stare down where we're looking in the refrigerator thinking, what am I going to fix tonight? It's also got some breakfast dishes. It's got obviously desserts, because even desserts are important. I believe in treating ourselves, and I don't believe in, you know, ruling out sweets, just, you know, in moderation. There are some side dishes, and there are, of course, even some breads. And that seems hard to believe that in a quick cookbook you could have bread, especially yeast bread, that has to take a while to rise. But we have some tricks that we use to make this whole process go more quickly, and that's really what the focus of the book about is, to get you in the kitchen, because I really think we're better off preparing our own food, particularly if we're on a special diet where we need to be really careful. This way, when you fix your own food, you have control over the ingredients, you have control over the standards under which your food is made, and you also, research shows, take in less calories and less fat and salt if you fix your own food, as opposed to eating out.
Carol Fenster, our guest today, author of 100 Best Quick Gluten-Free Recipes. Carol, I want to thank you for letting us post 3 of your recipes up on our Facebook page and our site. And I love them all. This microwave muffin in a mug, what a cool idea.
Isn't that a fun idea? You know, it's first of all, it's cute.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's a novelty, and you can make it for yourself. What I like to do is mix the ingredients up the night before. Keep the dry ingredients separate from the wet ones, of course, or otherwise it's going to rise before you get up the next morning. And then when you do get up, quickly whisk them together in a coffee mug, something that will withstand your microwave, because that's where you're going to cook it. And within a minute, you've got a puffy, warm, fairly nutritious muffin to start your day.
I loved it. And then you mentioned desserts earlier, and your flourless chocolate cupcakes sound and look wonderful, too.
Well, that recipe comes from an old standby of mine, which is a flourless chocolate cake, and it's usually baked in about an 8 or 9 inch round pan, and I serve it to my company all the time because it doesn't have any flour at all, hence the term flourless. And instead of flour, it uses ground up nuts. And unless you have a nut allergic person, which, you know, occasionally you do, it's such a nice thing to serve to everybody because it looks completely normal. Yeah. No one cares that it's gluten-free because it tastes so good. But to make it quicker, I decided to bake them that same recipe in cupcakes, which shaves about 15 minutes, maybe 15 or 20, off the total baking time. And in a busy cook's life, 15 or 20 minutes is a lot of time.
You know, and you do the same thing with a meatloaf.
Yes.
That I love that idea, and I'm gonna do that myself. So people have individual little containers, their own little meatloaves.
That's right. Just make it in a cupcake or muffin pan, and so you each have a little individual loaf. And you know what? If you do have leftovers, they are so easy to freeze too, and you can control portion size. There's all kinds of advantages, but they're just plain cute.
Carol Fenster, our guest today, author of a dozen books, including 100 Best Quick Gluten-Free Recipes. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with Carol Fenster about her book, 100 Best Quick Gluten-Free Recipes. And you know what, Carol? Every one of our lines is filled and has been filled for a while. So let's let's go to the phones.
Let's
Nancy
go.
In Manitowoc, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I love the Larry Mueller Show, and I love Carol Fenster. I want to thank her for the wonderful cookbook she's written. I have the Gluten-Free 101, and I have adapted almost everything I cook from this cookbook. I make my own bread. And I've always loved to cook from scratch. I had a myriad of health problems that disappeared within 4 days when I went wheat and gluten-free. The one issue I do have, even though I do love to cook from scratch, is the cost of all the gluten-free ingredients. I'm I'm wondering if, you know, we're going to see that change as more and more people adapt the gluten-free way of life, or perhaps a tax write-off on some of that. Could you address that, Carol?
Well, thanks for calling in, first of all, and those are two really good questions. Let me address the cost first. Other countries do allow you, well, in Italy, for example, your food is medically prescribed and you go to a pharmacy to pick it up and, you know, your insurance can cover it. I do know that here in America you can claim, you have to work with your accountant on this, and I'm not a CPA expert by any stretch, but you can claim on some foods the difference between what, let's say a loaf of bread, maybe you could pay $2 or $3 for a regular loaf of bread, but you and I have to pay around six or seven, somewhere in there, depending on whether it's on sale or not. The difference between that regular loaf and your gluten-free loaf in terms of cost can be used on your tax return and calculated. And again, your accountant can help you with that, but that's one thing you could look into. I guess you would probably need to have your receipts and save those, but that's something else. But the overall cost of food, our gluten-free food, I do think will go down eventually as manufacturers get more comfortable and, you know, in terms of sourcing the ingredients. But for right now, I haven't seen that happening. I think gluten-free products are still expensive, and they have been from day one. So what I like to tell people to do is just to be really careful with your storage. And if you live in a warm climate, I would store anything that's perishable, and that includes some of your whole grain flours. I would either refrigerate or freeze them to keep them, to preserve them as long as you can. Just bring them back to room temperature before you bake with them, because that can affect whether your baked goods rise very well or not. Have you looked into jointly buying some of the bigger, more expensive ingredients with other people and sharing them? That's something else that sometimes celiac support groups do. They'll buy in bulk and then, you know, divvy up. Whether that would work for you, I don't know. But those are just a few of the things that I try to do. And, of course, I just try to take very good care of the ingredients and treat them, you know, well, so I don't have any spoilage. And, of course, I store my flours in pest-free containers that no, you know, ants or bugs could get into. All those things are ways of preserving the money that we put into our very valuable mm-hmm. ingredients.
And I suppose, you know, just portions, watching the how much you make and making sure you use what you make.
Well, that's a good point, Larry. For example, I never throw away a slice of bread ever. If I have, let's say, leftover crackers or bread, I put it into my food processor and immediately make food breadcrumbs, whatever, cracker crumbs or breadcrumbs, and then I freeze them in my freezer, and then I always have them on hand.
On hand, yeah.
Yeah, and I save a ton of money by not having to buy, because there are gluten-free breadcrumbs and cracker crumbs out there, but I just think fresh is better, so I make my own.
Nancy, thanks again for calling. I appreciate it. Meryl in Walworth, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to respond to something that Carol just mentioned about not throwing anything out, and she's so right. I have two additional suggestions on that. There's nothing better than good French toast. If it's a little bit stale, soak it in some milk, and that's a delicious treat because you can't really go to a pancake house. So that's one. The other is bread pudding, which is an old-fashioned favorite of my family. So those are two recipe ideas. I wanted to follow up also on Carol's remark about the tax write-off. I have some additional information about that, if that would be helpful.
Sure.
When I was diagnosed 9 years ago, I had a special nutritionist in Tulsa, and she directed me to the Internal Revenue Service website. There is actually a document that you can download, and it's exactly as you indicated. You say what the equivalent would be of a regular loaf of bread, bag of noodles, can of soup, whatever the item is. You document what the normal range would be. You then indicate what you've spent for it, and you keep a log, essentially, if you're diligent enough to do that. And then you photocopy that. But you must have a doctor's prescription that verifies that you've been diagnosed with celiac for them to approve it. That's what I was told, and that turned out to be true for me as well. Hmm. So I wanted to share that. Also, one other thing that I was cautioned about, which was extremely helpful, and that is that when you are strictly maintaining the gluten-free diet, number one, you can alleviate so many health issues and increase your strength. But one of the cautions I was given was that with the substitutions that you make for that, with your starches, rice and corn, very healthy. However, rice and corn are very high in glycemic content and the sugar content. So I was advised to make certain that every year I watch carefully, especially as I'm a little bit older, to watch my sugar count to make certain that that's not getting out of control, just to monitor it and be careful with my portions.
Yeah. I think some good information here, Carol.
Great ideas. I appreciate especially your information on the tax information. I'm sure that's going to be really helpful for your listeners.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's turn to Jeff in Eau Claire next. Jeff, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for having me on. This is a subject I've given a lot of thought to over the last few years, and I welcome the chance to talk with your guest. I have a friend who has a son with celiac disease, and so I'm aware of the issues of cost and of dietary caution that affect people that cannot eat wheat. That, thankfully, is not a problem for me. I love pasta. Mm-hmm. I eat it for breakfast when I did eat pasta. And I love a crusty bread that you can knock on, and yet it's soft and tender inside. However, I've been looking into this for some time because, from my point of view, if you look at how we evolved and what we ate, processed flours and sugars and carbs were not part of that diet until just a few thousand years, and it's changed drastically in the last 60 years. My question to your guest was, would she comment on the risks of too much gluten in the diet for people that do not have a health problem, mm-hmm. and that they do not have celiac disease or reject it? Then I heard her say she wouldn't recommend going on a gluten-free diet if somebody didn't need to. So I would suggest, if you haven't heard of David Perlmutter, that's P-E-R-L-M-U-T-T-E-R-M-D. He's written a book called Grain Brain and some other works. He's a fellow of the American College of Nutrition, so he's an expert in nutrition, and he's a board-certified neurologist. And his father has dementia, so it's a big part of his passion to deal with the health of the brain, and gluten's a problem for the brain.
Let's get a comment from Carol. Carol, what?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your calling in, first of all, and bringing this up. Right now, there's a raging debate across all the experts about whether we all should be going off gluten and whether, you know, those of us who are really made sick by it are the only ones that need to avoid it. And I simply don't know what the answer is yet. I just heard a speaker two or three weeks ago, Dr. Rodney Ford, talking about the same thing. And I've read Dr. Perlmutter's book as well and all the other books that say, you know, we should be totally avoiding gluten. And they're all saying that it could be true that none of us really digest gluten, but for some of us it just passes on through our system and we go about our life and we don't seem to be ill. Maybe it's doing some sort of damage. And certainly they're starting to show that gluten is affecting our entire bodies, not just the intestine, which was what we used to think about celiac disease. It really affects your entire body. So, you know, as far as I know, the jury is still out. I just know that I watch people adopt a gluten-free diet very unknowing, without understanding the ramifications, and thinking that as long as that whatever box of gluten-free junk food they pick up is somehow going to be better for them than a box of regular junk food. And I'm sorry that they are mistaken, because they're not doing their bodies any good simply because the label of gluten-free is on the box. It's still junk food. And so, I agree, maybe we shouldn't. Eventually we're going to find out that we all shouldn't be eating gluten. For now, I haven't seen the research that emphatically says we, every single one of us, should give it up. But I certainly hear from people day in and day out about how their lives were changed for the better when they took gluten out. So I'm waiting with open arms to see what the eventual answer is.
Jevin, thank you very much for calling. I want to give some others a chance to join in, including, oh, by the way, Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer today, is doing her normal marvelous job, has got the tax link up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So if you we were talking about taxes and tax deductions, we have the link on the Facebook page, so you can go there for it. David in Singer, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. My daughter was diagnosed with gluten sensitivity a couple of years ago. She had a condition called eosinophilic enteritis. And in kids, basically that's an allergy thing, and in kids that's pretty much gluten. I also, as a physician, have diagnosed a number of people with celiac disease. So I have understanding from a medical perspective, but also very much a personal perspective. I could go on and on, but I think one of the things we sometimes forget is that it's a true allergy, so that even trace amounts can cause a problem. So if you put your gluten-free muffin in a toaster that has regular bread, it's no longer gluten-free, for example.
Yeah.
So the cross-contamination is a huge issue. You go to a restaurant, and they say, oh, we'll just take the bun off and give you the hamburger patty. That's got gluten on it. We're talking about perhaps 20 parts per million of gluten as being enough to cause a problem. Also, my daughter took 3 or 4 months to see a significant change. And that's often the case with gluten. It's not often that it's just a few days. There's obviously a lot that we still need to learn about the problem, though.
David, thank you so much for calling. Carol, a comment?
Yes, well, I'm really glad that your caller shared that with us. The whole issue of cross-contamination is huge, and it goes along with this burgeoning number of people who say, well, I think I'll just try a gluten-free diet for a while. They don't understand that cross-contamination is making an issue. And if they're trying to find out by giving up gluten for a while, if it's helping them at all, and if they keep getting it in their food because they're going to a restaurant that's not being really careful, they're not being careful at home, then they're never getting a true indication of, is gluten really my problem or not? And so there's all kinds of issues, but especially for the truly, truly sensitive, and those with definite wheat allergies are super sensitive. I have a young little grandson who has nut allergies and egg allergies, and we have to carry EpiPens with us at all time. So I am really aware of this whole cross-contamination issue, and it is a big one.
Yeah, it definitely is. David, thank you again for calling. I was thinking about my own daughter's school that has done, I think, an outstanding job. Because we have some children in that school who have intolerances, celiac is one, and then there are others with intolerance to nuts, and I'm really proud of our school for the job it has done, guarding against cross-contamination and that sort of thing. So it's really something that all schools need to be aware of, for sure.
Definitely, definitely.
And thanks again, David. By the way, you can join in. We have open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Are you an old hand at gluten-free cooking? Love to hear your tricks or tips, or maybe you're new to it and have some questions. Carol Fenster, who is the author of a dozen books on gluten-free diets, including the one we're talking about now. It's her latest. It's called 100 Best Quick Gluten-Free Recipes. I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Facebook, from a question from Andrew. My brother-in-law's sister is celiac, so I'm working on a gluten-free stuffing recipe for Thanksgiving. Any advice on my bread choices? Keep in mind that I'm also vegan, so I'm trying to make it as hard as possible for you.
That's a good question. We're coming up on Thanksgiving and the other holidays, aren't we? Well, a couple suggestions. It's going to be, if you're vegan, that means you avoid eggs. And it's going to be hard to find a bread, a commercial gluten-free bread, that has no eggs in it. They may be out there. I just am not sure that I know of one at the moment to suggest to you. You could do a quick scan through your local natural food store and see. But the other option is to, of course, bake your own. And I like to make cornbread stuffing, and you can make a pretty decent cornbread without eggs using various egg replacements. One of them might be soft silken tofu, and you use 1/4 cup for each egg that would have been in your regular recipe. Obviously, you're going to make a gluten-free version of this, so we're okay there. Other options I've tried are a tablespoon of flax, ground up flax meal in 1/4 cup of water, and that can replicate and let it sit for a while till it gets kind of viscous to kind of seem like egg texture, and use 1/4 cup of that for every egg. So you could make a really good cornbread that way, and then use the same amounts that you would use in a regular recipe. And generally speaking, all the other ingredients should be okay. You want to watch the chicken broth, if that's what you're using, because that can have wheat in it, but simply read the label and check it out. And you can do pretty well with a Thanksgiving stuffing for a vegan, gluten-free person.
There you go. And as long as we're kind of on cooking, baking, and so forth, Chuck in Green Bay emailed and wondered, the gluten-free flour is not enriched, so when you eat baked goods, they are basically starch. What do you do to enrich the flour you use?
Yeah, and I was alluding to that earlier when I said that when you give up traditional breads and pastas, you're giving up all that fortification. Most of our gluten-free foods are not fortified. Some are, but most are not. The ways to do that are to include a little bit of a gluten-free flour that is extremely nutritious, and I'm thinking now of ones such as buckwheat or amaranth or quinoa. Those flours are very nutritious, and they are whole grain flours in the sense that when they're ground in the mill, they don't take the bran or the outsides off. They're usually too little for that. And so when they grind them into flour, the entire grain is there, so you're not missing anything. Other ways of injecting more nutrients would be to use nut flours and bean flours. I'm very fond of using bean flours in baking because they do such wonderful things for flavor and texture. And I like using almonds and walnuts and pecans ground up as fine as you can get them before they turn to a butter, because they will do that if you grind them up in your food processor eventually, because I've learned that the hard way. So stop before they become a nut butter, and then include a little bit of that. It depends on what recipe you're using and how large the recipe is as to how much you would want to use. But typically speaking, I would add, not knowing anything about what the recipe you're using, no more than 25%. Replace 25% of your flour with one of those flours. And, of course, you can find recipes that are strictly based on nuts and beans, and that's another way to approach it, is seek out those cookbooks that, you know, that have that focus, and then you are naturally increasing your protein and fiber intake in a healthy way. But that's certainly an issue, and I'm glad that your caller brought that up. I do get saddened sometimes about the lack of nutrients in some of the flours that we need to use for baking. Yeah. But those are ways of boosting the nutrients with nuts and beans and whole grain flours.
Carol in Wisconsin had wondered, Wisconsin Rapids had wondered about xanthan gum. She was diagnosed with celiac about 12 years ago. Still has problems with the amounts of xanthan gum required in various baked goods.
Mm-hmm.
Could you have some general guidelines for the use of it?
Finding that we can probably get by with a little less xanthan gum in baking than we thought we needed. And I'm even experimenting with some of my own recipes about cutting back on it. It's expensive, for one thing. It's very expensive. But you don't need a whole lot to make a difference. But I think in things like breads and cakes that you want to rise high and look, you know, like normal cakes and breads, you do need xanthan gum. Another gum that we see used a lot is guar gum. It's a little less readily available on the store shelves, and I'm not totally certain why. But it also works quite well in baking. There's always been this concern that it's got so much fiber that it's going to be dangerous for a celiac to use because it might damage their intestines. But I have never heard of anyone actually having that particular difficulty. But again, for your caller, I would try cutting back maybe 25%. And it depends on what you're making. Try cutting back 25% on the xanthan gum and see what happens. If that works, then try another 25% and keep ratcheting back the amount until you get to a point where, you know, you need to use it. If you don't use xanthan gum in certain baked goods, they won't rise at all. They'll simply be like hockey pucks. They'll be hard and dense, and you won't have that lovely crumb that we look for in baked goods, and it's probably something you're going to end up throwing away.
There you go.
And that's a waste.
Yeah, that's a waste. Lori in Green Bay, hi.
Hello. A year or so ago, I read something about a woman who had some kind of sensitivity to gluten, and she went overseas to Europe, and she couldn't resist the delicious bakery there, so she decided she'd just put up with the discomfort that she had to deal with having the bakery, and nothing happened. And I've heard other people too who have that, who's had that experience, and I've never heard if it's because of the pesticides we use, if we've hybridized grains, and maybe that's been the problem with our grains as opposed to theirs. But
you know, I've heard those stories too, time and again, and I haven't experienced it because I'm afraid to eat any wheat at all because I do get sick. But I've heard people say that they have done better in Europe, and I don't know why. There are several theories offered. One of them is that European wheat is somehow different, and of course, lower, by different they mean lower in gluten than ours. I don't know if that's true, but that's always the explanation that people seem to offer the most, is that it's a different form of wheat. And yeah, maybe the pesticide thing, I don't know. I simply don't know the answer, but I've heard this story often. And there is debate right now about whether the wheat that we eat in America is the same that we ate 50 years ago. And there are some people who say, no, it's not. It's been bred to be a shorter version so the stalks don't bend over and we don't have as much loss and spoilage in the field. Other experts, one of them is Dr. Don Casarda, and his name is spelled Kasarda. Formerly, I think, with the USDA, but he's retired now, but he's kind of been our go-to guy in the gluten-free world as to about our grains. He says that our wheat today does not look that much different than it did 50 years ago. And he's saying that there's certainly not any more gluten in it than there was back then. So I don't know what the answer is. I wish I did, because maybe there is something we could learn here in America about the way we prepare our food. But at the moment, I don't have an answer.
Lori, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. And Carol, thank you so much. And I mentioned two of the recipes that you've given us to post on our Facebook page, but the other one, someone had asked about good pasta recommendations for gluten-free, and you have a penne alla vodka recipe that that sounds awfully good to me that I'd like to try.
And it's super quick and easy. I buy several brands of pasta. What I suggest you do is try them all and see what you like. I'm particularly fond of a couple of brands that I use in the book, but others may like a different brand. It depends on what you like. So try them all, pick one out, and that's the one you buy.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and thank you, Carol, so much for talking with us. I hope we have a chance to visit again.
I hope so, too, Larry, and thank you so much, and have a terrific day.
You as well. Carol Fenster is the author of a dozen gluten-free cookbooks, including her latest, the one we're talking about today, 100 Best Quick Gluten-Free Recipes. She also authored the award-winning 1,000 Gluten-Free Recipes, former associate editor at Living Without magazine, and her work has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Gluten-Free Living, and elsewhere as well. So really a lot of fun to talk with her about her recipes. And I know this thing is going to be a lot of fun to talk with our next guest as well. Jan Dunlap is someone we've visited with a number of times about her Bob White murder mystery series, murder mystery series. Interviewed her about that. She's got a new book out that's quite different from that format, and it's titled Saved by Gracie. And I think you're going to enjoy hearing her story coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.